This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Broadband, the untold story of the women who made the internet. This is the author, Claire L. Evans. For the users. Introduction. The Dell. When I was younger, I had a Dell. It was a beige box fastened to the internet with a 28.8K modem that screeched with every connection. Its keys were as tall as sugar cubes and slightly concave. The installation occupied the elbow of an L-shaped desk in my bedroom's inner sanctum. Over the years, I laid stickers in geological strata across the white laminate of my desk. Peeled one at a time, they'd have revealed earlier versions of the girl sticking them, like a candy passing through its flavors as it melts in the mouth. A teenage girl's room is a cockpit, an altar, and a womb. It contains her most sacred things, and it holds her as she grows, until eventually it ejects her into the world. The Dell underwent its own changes. It ran every Microsoft operating system from MS-DOS to Windows 95. The DOS era was wonderful. Games on floppy disk, terminal commands. Over time, my monitor's blunt plastic bezel thickened with coats of glitter nail polish and post-it notes. "Get a life," I wrote across the Dell's frame, in Sharpie, in anger, in devotion. When the internet came into my life, it was as though my monitor became a glass gate. It opened to an infinite channel. When the modem stuttered, I'd shower it in compliments. "You are such a good modem, and I believe you can do anything." It was my own compulsive folk tradition. I believed then that information, like people, needed support on its journey across the world. In my early years online, I learned how to write HTML and built rudimentary sites honoring my favorite bands. I sent passionate emails to estranged summer camp friends. I found answers to the questions I was too shy to ask. I made pen pals I was afraid of meeting. I journaled in pocket communities now obsolete. In short, I became myself, enjoying the freedoms the computer afforded me. Freedoms both from isolation, shyness, ignorance, and to learn, experiment, discover, and play. I abandoned the Dell when I left for college with a Sony Vaio, one of those tragic interstitial laptop models that will likely populate future museums of technology, with a detachable base that served mostly to heat the tops of my thighs. Like most consumer electronics in the United States, the Dell was likely landfilled, or else dispatched by container ship to China, Malaysia, India, or Kenya, where it was disarticulated like a chicken carcass, cables snipped, guts stripped of valuable metals and ores. Today, I think about how the glitter-encrusted monitor must have looked to the underpaid laborers working in a toxic field of unprocessed e-waste who ground my Dell into plastic dust. Even once they've grown obsolete, computers never fully disappear. They only become somebody else's problem. Being mass-produced, they form part of our cultural memory, avatars, like my Dell, of childhood landscapes, or like the Macintosh I never had, of personal computing as a whole. Doubtless, this is why we so often consider the history of technology as a row of progressively smarter machines, from Chinese abacai to room-sized cabinets tended by pliant workers, from refrigerators with cathode ray screens to ever smaller incarnations of silicon and plastic, dwindling finally to the familiar handheld pane of glass. Anywhere along the line, it's tempting to eulogize the box, to point to one and say, "The people who made this changed the world." This story is not about those people. This is a book about women. It's also a book about the use of computers, real and potential. This is not to say that men make and women use. Far from it. Only that the technological history we're usually told is one about men and machines, ignoring women and the signals they compose. Female mental labor was the original information technology, and women elevated the rudimentary operation of computing machines into an art called programming. They gave language to the box. They wrestled brute mainframes into public service, showing how the products of industry could serve the people, if the intent was there. when the internet was still an unruly assortment of hosts. They built protocols to direct the flow of traffic and help it grow. Before the World Wide Web came into our lives, female academics and computer scientists created systems to turn vast storehouses of digital information into knowledge. We abandoned those in favor of brute simplicity. Women built empires in the dot-com era, and they were among the earliest to establish and grow virtual communities. The lessons they learned in the process would serve us well today, if we'd listen. None of this quantifies cleanly, which makes these women's contributions to computing difficult to catalog and even harder to memorialize. Although this book owes a debt of gratitude to the fine historical research it cites, I also drew from first-person accounts given by the women in these pages and from the fragmentary documentation characteristic of technological history. Screenshots, chat logs, abandonware, outdated manuals, and eroded web pages. I've done my best to explore what software artifacts remain, learning Unix commands and the social conventions of old-world online culture with the diligence of a student abroad. May the servers whir long enough to support more virtual tourism, because these places will become only more precarious with time. An irony. Even as computer memory multiplies, our ability to hold on to personal memories remains a matter of will, bounded by the skull and expanded only by our capacity to tell stories. There are technical women in these pages, some of the brightest programmers and engineers in the history of the medium. There are academics and hackers, and there are culture workers too, pixel pushers and game designers and the self-proclaimed biggest bitch in Silicon Alley. Wide as their experiences are, they've all got one thing in common. They all care deeply about the user. They are never so seduced by the box that they forget why it's there, to enrich human life. If you're looking for women in the history of technology, look first where it makes life better, easier, and more connected. Look for the places where form gives way to function. A computer is a machine that condenses the world into numbers to be processed and manipulated. Making this comprehensible to as many people as possible, regardless of technical skill, is not an essentially feminine pursuit. Nothing is. That being said, the women I talk to all seem to understand it implicitly and to value it as fundamental, inalienable, and right. To live with a box that connects the world to itself is expansive, life-altering, and even a little magic. But the box itself is still only an object. If not taken to pieces and recycled, it'll poison Earth for millennia. A permanence justifiable only if we believe what happens before the landfill is worthwhile. Spiritual, even. Computers are built to be turned on. Cables are meant to be patched in. And links are made to be clicked. Without the human touch, current may run, but the signal stops. We animate the thing. We give it meaning. And in that meaning lies its worth. History books celebrate the makers of machines, but it's the users, and those who design for the users, who really change the world. Women turn up at the beginning of every important wave in technology. We're not ancillary, we're central, often hiding in plain sight. Some of the most wondrous contributions in these pages bloomed in the grubby medians of the information superhighway. Before a new field developed its authorities, and long before there was money to be made, women experimented with new technologies and pushed them beyond their design. Again and again, women did the jobs nobody thought were important, until they were. Even computer programming was initially passed off onto the girls, hired to patch cables and nothing more, until the cables became patterns, and the patterns became language, and suddenly programming was something worth mastering. A few notes before we go. I take as a given in this book that sex is to gender as body is to soul. Woman means something different for everyone. There's no end to the ways in which it can be inhabited, and any loosening of the categories liberates a great many individual lives. That being said, women often share experiences, and particularly in environments where we are in the minority, it's nice to look for commonalities that can bolster our solidarity. One more. The history of computers is an alphabet salad. We'll meet ENIAC and UNIVAC and ARPANET and Plato and the World Wide Web, www. It can be difficult to read these acronyms without feeling like the past is yelling at you. Please don't despair. It's half the fun. Onward now. My Dell is gone. Its memory wiped. What remains of it isn't etchings on a hard drive, but markings on a person. The user pushing symbols around. My memories of the Dell are like memories I have of family and friends. They're memories of time spent together, of journeys traveled. Memories of revelation and transgression. That's the miraculous thing about technology. It's never wholly separate from us. Just as a hammer strengthens the hand, or a lens the sight, the computer amplifies a person, extending the touch of even a teenage girl into the world. I am the computer, and the computer is me. I won't be the last to feel this way, and I certainly wasn't the first. Part 1. The Kilo Girls. Chapter 1. A Computer Wanted. It's 1892 in New York City. In January, an immigration processing center called Ellis Island opened for business. In March, in Springfield, Massachusetts, a YMCA instructor, desperate to keep a class of stir-crazy youngsters entertained indoors, hosted the first public game of basketball. But the winter is over, and it's the 1st of May, just shy of summer, just shy of the 20th century. It's before the screen, the mouse, the byte, the pixel, and 100 years before my Dell. But there's a strange notice in the classified pages of the New York Times. A computer wanted, it says. This ad is the first instance of the word computer in print. It wasn't placed by an indiscreet time traveler, someone trapped in the Gilded Age and jonesing for the familiar glow of their MacBook. It was placed by the United States Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., which was by then several decades into a mathematical astronomy project, calculating, by hand, the positions of the sun, stars, moon, and planets across the night sky. The observatory's directors were not in the market that spring to buy a computer. They were looking to hire one. For close to 200 years, a computer was a job, as in someone who computes or performs computations for a living. Had one been browsing the Times that May day in 1892 and decided to answer the classified ad, they'd soon be taking an algebra test. The Naval Observatory job was cushy, relatively. Those who lived nearby worked in a cozy, informal office in Cambridge, far from the observatory itself, which was perched on a bluff above the Potomac. They clocked five-hour days, charting the skies from individual tables by a roaring fire, pausing often to discuss the scientific ideas of the day. The rest worked from home, from detailed mathematical plans they received in the mail. Computing, as one historian has noted, was the original cottage industry. Every day, these computers, much as computers do today, would chip away at complicated, large-scale math problems. They wouldn't do it alone. Our new hire would be part of a team, everyone crunching their share of the numbers, some correcting each other's work for extra income. With pen and paper alone, the Naval Observatory team would chart the skies, just as other computing offices throughout the Western world would advance ballistics, maritime navigation, or pure mathematics. They wouldn't receive much individual credit, but whatever the problem was, they'd have been instrumental in solving it. Computing offices were thinking factories. The 19th century British mathematician, Charles Babbage, whose desire to calculate by steam led to important early developments in mechanical computing, called what the human computing offices of his time did mental labor. He considered it work one did with the brain, just as hammering a nail is work one does with the arm. Indeed, computing was the grunt labor of organized science. Before they were made obsolete, human computers prepared ballistics trajectories for the United States Army, cracked Nazi codes at Bletchley Park, crunched astronomical data at Harvard, and assisted numerical studies of nuclear fission on the Manhattan Project. Despite the diversity of their work, human computers had one thing in common. They were women. Mostly, anyway. The Naval Observatory hired only one female computer for its nautical almanac office, although she was by far the most famous among them. Maria Mitchell, a Quaker from Nantucket Island, who had won a medal from the King of Denmark before she was 30 for discovering a new comet in the night sky. It came to be known as Miss Mitchell's Comet. At the observatory, Mitchell calculated the ephemeris of Venus, being, as her supervisor told her, the only computer fair enough to tackle the fairest of the planets. Her presence as a woman in a computing group was unusual for its time, but it would only become less so. Maria Mitchell discovered her comet only a year before the Seneca Falls Conference on the Rights of Women, which was largely organized by Quaker activists. Her church was the sole religious denomination allowing women to preach to its congregations, and Maria's father, an amateur astronomer, lobbied aggressively for her accomplishments to be recognized. Before the end of the 20th century, however, computing would become largely the purview of women. It was female mental laborers, breaking intractable problems down into numerical steps, much as machines tackle problems today, who ushered in the age of large-scale scientific research. By the mid-20th century, computing was so much considered a woman's job that when computing machines came along, evolving alongside and largely independently from their human counterparts, mathematicians would guesstimate their horsepower by invoking girl years and describe units of machine labor as equivalent to one kilogirl. This is the story of the kilogirls. It begins, as the most beautiful patterns do, with a loom. The spider work. The loom is a simple technology, but in the warp and weft of thread lies the weaving of all technologically literate society. Textiles are central to the business of being human, and like software, they are encoded with meaning. As the British cultural theorist Sadie Plant observes, every cloth is a record of its weaving, an interconnected matrix of skills, time, materials, and personnel. The visible pattern of any cloth, she writes, is integral to the process which produced it. The program and the pattern are continuous. This process, of course, historically concerns women. Around looms, at spinning wheels, in sewing circles, in ancient Egypt and China, and in southeastern Europe 5 centuries before Christianity, women have woven clothing, shelter, the signifiers of status, even currency. Like many accepted patterns, this was disrupted by the Industrial Revolution, when a French weaver, Joseph-Marie Jacquard, proposed a new way to create cloth, not by hand, but by the numbers. Unlike a traditional loom, singularly animated by its weaver's ingenuity, Jacquard's invention produced remarkably complex textiles from patterns punched into sequences of paper cards, reproducible and consistent beyond a margin of human error. The resulting damask, brocade, and quilted matelassé became highly coveted all over Europe, but the impact of Jacquard's loom went far beyond industrial textile production. His punched cards, which separated pattern from process for the first time in history, would eventually find their way into the earliest computers. Patterns encoded on paper, which computer scientists later called programs, could meaningfully entangle numbers as easily as thread. The Jacquard loom put skilled laborers, male and female, out of work. Some took out their anger on the frames of the new machines, claiming as a folk hero the apocryphal Ned Ludd, a weaver said to have smashed a pair of stocking frames at the end of the previous century. We use the term Luddite now, in the pejorative, to describe anyone with an unreasonable aversion to technology. But the cause was not unpopular in its time. Even Lord Byron sympathized. In his maiden speech to the House of Lords in 1812, he defended the organized frame breakers by comparing the results of a Jacquard loom's mechanical weaving to spider work. Privately, he worried that, in his sympathy for the Luddites, he might be taken as half a frame breaker himself. He was, of course, not. And he was dead wrong about the spider work, too. Even as Byron made his case, Jacquard looms were producing a quality and volume of textiles unlike anything the world had ever seen. The mathematician Charles Babbage owned a portrait of Joseph-Marie Jacquard, woven from thousands of silk threads using 24,000 punch cards. A weaving so intricate that it was regularly mistaken for an engraving by his guests. And although the portrait was a fine possession, it was the loom itself and its punch card programs that really ignited Babbage's imagination. "It is a known fact," Babbage proclaimed, "that the Jacquard loom is capable of weaving any design which the imagination of man may conceive. As long as that imagination could be translated into a pattern, it could be infinitely reproduced, in any volume, in any material, at any level of detail, in any combination of colors, without degradation." Babbage understood the profundity of the punched paper program because mathematical formulae work the same way. Run them again and again, and they never change. He was so taken with the Jacquard loom, in fact, that he spent the better part of his life designing computing machines fed by punch cards. To describe how these worked, he even adopted the language of the textile factory, writing of a store to hold the numbers and a mill where they could be processed, analogous to a modern computer's memory and central processing unit. Numbers would move through Babbage's machines, coming together as thread becomes whole cloth. Babbage's machines, the difference engine, a hand-cranked mechanical calculator designed to tabulate polynomial functions, and the more complex analytical engine, were so far ahead of their time that they're generally considered historical anachronisms. His mechanical designs required a level of technical precision never before attempted, although the British government, for whom mathematical tables were a point of national interest, was willing to try. It funded construction of the difference engine in 1823. With an initial grant of £1,700. By the time it wrote off the project, nearly 20 years later, having spent 10 times as much, there was still nothing to show for what the Prime Minister had by then determined to be a very costly toy, and worthless as far as science is concerned, save some partial models and 400 square feet of confounding schematic drawings. The machines made Babbage famous, and perhaps infamous. But very few people alive in his time were mentally equipped to understand what they were supposed to do, let alone how. One of those people was Lord Byron's daughter, Ada. In her short life, she would make one thing certain: that the spider work her father had so disdained would proliferate, unstoppable, into the following century and beyond. Rays from every corner of the universe. Ada's alchemy was peculiar. She was the child of a passionate year-long marriage between Byron and a bright, mathematically inclined aristocrat named Anne Isabella Milbank, or Annabella. Byron was, in a former lover's estimation, mad, bad, and dangerous to know, his passions romantic in every sense. Annabella, on the other hand, was so sensible and well-bred that Byron teasingly called her the Princess of Parallelograms. The couple separated amid rumors that the louche Byron had a more than fraternal relationship with his half-sister, Augusta. Amid the scandal of that separation, the last thing Annabella wanted was for Ada to inherit any of her father's wildness, or to suffer as a consequence of his notoriety. To keep her daughter on the straight and narrow, Annabella began a rigorous course of mathematical instruction from the time Ada was 4 years old. Math. The opposite of poetry. Or so she thought. Byron absconded to Italy shortly after Ada's birth. He never made her acquaintance, although he inquired after her often. "Is the girl imaginative?" he wrote to Augusta, knowing full well that Annabella, who kept their daughter purposefully secluded, would divulge nothing directly. Byron died unromantically of the flu in Greece in 1824, when Ada was only 9. As he died, he called to his valet, "Oh, my poor dear child, my dear Ada. My God, could I have seen her? Give her my blessing." His body was returned to England by ship, and huge crowds gathered in the streets of London to see his funeral procession of 47 carriages. When Ada finally learned her father's name, she wept for him, although it doesn't appear that she or her mother held his legacy in high esteem. Byron's portrait in their home was concealed under heavy drapery until Ada was 20. But his mercurial spirit was alive in her. "I do not believe that my father was, or ever could have been, such a poet as I shall be an analyst and metaphysician," she wrote to Charles Babbage later in life. "For with me, the two go together indissolubly." Ada's sharp analytical mind was inflected by a wild imagination. Prevented from a formal university education by her gender, She thrived under private tutelage. A precocious and very lonely child, she designed flying machines and marched around the billiard table playing violin. She was also frequently ill, prone to episodes of what was then called hysteria, and barely survived a serious 3-year bout of measles, during which Annabella took advantage of her daughter's bedridden condition to double down on schoolwork. But Ada was indomitable, agitated, and charismatic, and when she outpaced, and in one case seduced, her tutors, she educated herself with books and through correspondence with some of 19th century England's most illustrious minds. She was only a teenager when she struck up a close friendship with the well-known scientist Mary Somerville, who would answer her questions and encourage her studies. The logician Augustus De Morgan sent her problems by post, only to be astounded by the power of thinking represented in her responses. Had she been a man, he marveled, her aptitude for grasping the strong points and the real difficulties of first principles would have made her an original mathematical investigator, perhaps of first-rate eminence. She did not shrink away from difficulty, and she had a peculiar way of learning. She questioned the basic principles of mathematics to drill down to their fundamental meaning and understand them completely. Ada first met Charles Babbage when she and her mother went to see his difference engine, the first of his very expensive, very unfinished mathematical machines, in London. She was 17, Babbage was 42. He displayed the machine, a piece of it anyway, in a salon where he hosted Saturday night soirees that attracted the most prominent names in society. Charles Darwin, Michael Faraday, Charles Dickens, the Duke of Wellington. It wasn't long after Ada's ritual debut in court, where she had worn satin and tulle and made whispered pronouncements to her mother about the various dukes to whom she was presented. Wellington she liked, and the Duke of Orléans, too. But the Duke of Talleyrand? He was an old monkey. Ada diligently made the rounds, but she held her social obligations in low esteem. She was, however, immediately mesmerized by Babbage's machine, a hulking block of interlinked brass gears and cogs. While other visitors gazed at the working of this beautiful instrument with the sort of expression, and I dare say the sort of feeling, that some savages are said to have shown on first seeing a looking glass or hearing a gun, wrote an onlooker. Miss Byron, young as she was, understood its working and saw the great beauty of the invention. Not long afterward, Ada became Ada Augusta King after her marriage to a sensible aristocrat a decade her senior, and then, 3 years later, her husband's peerage elevated, the Countess of Lovelace. By the age of 24, she'd borne 3 children, one a son named after her father, and was managing her family's homes in Surrey and London. But she continued to study mathematics every day, and she remained fascinated by the difference engine. She pleaded with Babbage to let her be of service to his machines. "I hope you are bearing me in mind," she wrote to him in 1840. "I mean my mathematical interests. You know this is the greatest favor anyone can do me." Being a countess came with social obligations Ada found immensely distracting from her true passions. She wanted a professional path, a vocation, to practice mathematics in some useful way that might cement her legacy as her father's poems had cemented his. Her letters, to Babbage, to her mother, to her many friends, reveal a woman consumed by the crippling fear that she might not have the opportunity to make her mark on mathematics. She was certain of her own unique talents. Both her immense reasoning faculties, drilled into her by her mother's homeschooling, and her intuitive perception of hidden things, the legacy of her absent father. "I can throw rays from every quarter of the universe into one vast focus," she wrote to her mother, who worried she might be mad. Ada had affection for her husband. She called him my chosen pet. But she devoted her mental life to Babbage and his machines. She became his acolyte, and then his mouthpiece. His iconoclastic way of thinking appealed to her. She admired the imagination of his inventions. Having been raised in isolation, under the rigorous tutelage of a mother hell-bent on curbing any trace of Lord Byron's poetical fancies, Ada felt validated by Babbage. Like her, he understood that the manipulation of numbers, the highest levels of mathematical thought, had profound metaphysical implications. That math was a form of poetry in itself. But by the time Ada was married, Babbage had all but given up on the difference engine. Impressive as it might have been to the British society passing through his Saturday soirees, it was only a very complicated adding machine, churning out rows and rows of numbers using the method of finite differences. The difference engine could have been used to tabulate error-free mathematical tables, to precisely calculate by steam the sorts of things human computers had by then been doing with only occasional errors for more than a century. But Babbage was no longer interested in anything so practical. He had a bigger idea. The difference engine's precisely milled cogs and wheels stored thousands of numbers, but Babbage longed that they store variables instead. Abstract symbols standing in for numbers. Such a machine could do much more than arithmetic. It would be capable of solving every kind of problem. He began to make plans for a second, far more ambitious engine, one that would make the conceptual leap from mechanized arithmetic to full-fledged general-purpose computation. He called it the analytical engine. If the difference engine was ingenious, the analytical engine was brilliant. Had it ever been fully built, the analytical engine would have been able to multiply 2 20-digit numbers in 3 minutes. The Harvard Mark I, an electromechanical computer built in the 1940s, using some of Babbage's basic computing principles, was capable of the same task in about 6 seconds, albeit nearly 100 years later. Today, my laptop does it in under a millionth of a second. But the analytical engine was not an electronic machine. It was a cumbersome, mechanical thing, its cranks, rods, and spinning gear wheels designed to be powered by steam. The word engine is right. To an untrained eye, the partial model of the analytical engine currently on display at the Science Museum in London looks like something pulled from the belly of a train. It has the formidable and hulking physical presence of a bank vault. It was a tough sell. After all the money it had wasted on Babbage's difference engine, the British government certainly wasn't going to spring for a new model with even fewer immediate applications. And Babbage had nobody to lean on. In his obstinacy, he'd made his share of enemies in the British scientific community. In the hopes of stoking interest in his machine, Babbage accepted an invitation in the fall of 1840 to go to Turin and share his plans for the analytical engine with a group of Italian scientists and philosophers. He hoped that the country of Archimedes and Galileo might prove more enlightened than his homeland, but things didn't go as planned. Seated in Babbage's Turin audience was a certain L.F. Menabrea, a young military engineer who would later become a diplomat and then the Italian prime minister. Soon after the presentation, Menabrea wrote a detailed paper, Notions sur la machine analytique, for a Swiss journal. When the intellectually curious Ada came across the paper, she immediately began to translate it, correcting Menabrea's mistakes as she went. She presented the unsolicited translation to Babbage. Impressed, he asked her why she hadn't just written an original paper, seeing as she was so familiar with the machine and its architect. The thought had not occurred to her. Babbage suggested that she should, at least, add some of her own notes to the translation. This compromise between modesty and intellectual ambition was amenable, and she undertook the project straight away. But by the time they made it to the printer's office, Ada's notes, which she signed only with her initials, AAL, had taken on a life of their own. They were nearly 3 times longer than Menabrea's original text, and an order of magnitude more sophisticated. In her notes, Ada synthesized the vast scope of Babbage's vision. It was no easy task. By the time he died, he'd dedicated 30 volumes of plans to the analytical engine. Enlivening her technical analysis with flights of metaphysical fancy, she aimed to make the machine comprehensible and exciting for an educated Victorian audience, particularly those among the scientific community and the British government, whom Ada and Babbage both hoped would come to their senses regarding the machine. Babbage was obstinate and not a particularly good political player, and Ada knew his brilliance could easily be overlooked by those who found his temperament intolerable. "My dear and much admired interpretress," he admitted. But Ada didn't only explain the technical workings of the analytical engine. She imagined the impact it could have on the world, teasing out the implications of general-purpose computing to anticipate the transformative power of software. She understood that if the analytical engine manipulated symbols, then anything that could be represented symbolically, numbers, logic, even music, could pass through the machine and do wondrous things. "The analytical engine weaves algebraical patterns," she wrote, using a textile metaphor, "just as the Jacquard loom weaves flowers and leaves." The possibilities were limitless, and hers was just the mind to articulate them, mathematically brilliant and poetically incisive in equal measure. The work was taxing on her, mentally as well as physically. Like many patients at the time, she was prescribed laudanum for her maladies. Through an opiate haze, she labored in bursts of feverish energy between social appointments and periods of illness. Her mother disapproved, and she tried to contrive family dramas to distract her. But Ada was tenacious. Correspondence between Ada and Babbage during this time was brisk and highly intimate. They sent letters back and forth across London, often several times a day. She chided him for his sloppy work, bristled when he edited her writing, and caught his errors, all the while referring to herself as his fairy, an apt description for the mathematical sprite she was. "That brain of mine is something more than merely mortal," she boasted, as she sorted out all the ways the machine could deduce Bernoulli numbers. "Before 10 years are over, the devil's in it if I have not sucked out some of the lifeblood from the mysteries of this universe in a way that no purely mortal lips or brains could do." The analytical engine would never be completed, but it represents the conceptual dawn of the computer age. The four components of its design, input, storage, processing, and output, remain core components of all computers today. And the strikingly original notes that Ada prepared to explain this new kind of machine would presage the literature of computer science by nearly a century. To demonstrate how the engine could calculate Bernoulli numbers without any assistance from a human hand or head, she wrote mathematical proofs that many scholars characterize as the first computer programs ever written, and all for a machine that never even existed. Although Ada had 3 children, she referred to her notes on Menabrea's essay as her firstborn. "He is an uncommonly fine baby," she wrote to Babbage upon completing her draft, "and he will grow to be a man of the first magnitude and power." It's telling of Ada's time that she characterized her work as male and signed her notes with only her initials. Although she was encouraged in her lifetime by high-profile supporters, Babbage chief among a circle that included her tutors, husband, and scientific friends, her path was decidedly unorthodox. Even her mother barely tolerated it. "Not even countesses," writes Sadie Plant, "were supposed to count." Beyond her friend Mary Somerville, she had few female peers, and her accomplishments required a dogged and persistent self-education, a near manic dedication to mathematics that defied convention and damaged her health. Ada had been prone to illness her entire life, suffering from bouts of dizziness, pain, fainting, and nervous malcontent. Her symptoms were written off as hysteria and managed with her regular doses of laudanum, which she anticipated eagerly, her eyes burning. At 36, the same age as her father, Ada died of what really ailed her, uterine cancer. She had all but given up on mathematics. In her final years, she bet compulsively on horse races, using her mathematical acuity to calculate odds for an ad hoc syndicate of male friends. One biographer has suggested that she hoped to win the fortune required to build Babbage's analytical engine, but she lost so often and so spectacularly that she was forced to borrow money from friends and pawn family jewels. By the time she succumbed to protracted bed rest in London, she had become more like her father, mad, bad, and dangerous, than any princess of parallelograms. Floating in and out of reality with doses of laudanum, wine, and chloroform, she echoed the family chord of recklessness and tragedy. "I do dread that horrible struggle, which I fear is in the Byron blood," she wrote to her mother. "I don't think we die easy." Like her father's, Ada's work outlived her, although it would be nearly a century before it was properly recognized. It took until the beginning of the computer age, when the magnitude of their prescience became undeniable, for her notes to be republished in a British computing symposium. Its editor marveled, in 1953, that Her ideas are so modern that they have become of great topical interest once again. Ada was lucky to have been born wealthy, noble, and relatively idle. Even without a professional path, she was able to educate herself, and she had time to privately follow her passions. Still, she could have done so much more, and it's evident that she wanted to. Many brilliant women, born in the wrong centuries, the wrong places, or hoping to make an impact on the wrong field, have suffered similar fates, and far worse. Reading Ada's correspondence, I see someone I wish I could reach out to across the centuries and say, "You're right. Nobody can see it but you. But you will have inheritors, granddaughters and great-granddaughters. They will sprout up everywhere, all over the world, and work with the same dogged, unrelenting focus. Other people will keep getting the credit until one day they won't anymore. And then your history will be written 100 times. By teenage girls at their desks in the heart of their kingdoms, on machines beyond your wildest imagination." Kilo Girls. By her insistence, Ada Lovelace was buried next to her father in a small church near his ancestral estate of Newstead Abbey. Her coffin, finished in soft violet velvet, bore an inscription of the Lovelace family motto, an axiom she'd embraced as her own while toiling over her notes on Babbage's analytical engine. "Labor ipse voluptas," it read. "Labor is its own reward." Labor would remain its own reward for a long time. By the end of Ada's century, although technically gifted women like her could find employment as computers on either side of the Atlantic, their formal titles weren't accompanied by commensurate status or compensation. In the 1880s, for example, the astronomer Edward Charles Pickering hired only women to analyze and classify stellar data for his Harvard lab, including his own maid, Wilhelmina Fleming. Although he would later champion the women working in the observatory, even presenting papers on Fleming's behalf at astronomical conferences, Pickering didn't hire them out of advocacy. He just wanted twice as many workers on the job, given that women were paid half the going rate. "The Harvard computers are mostly women," complained the director of a competing observatory, which employed only men, to a colleague. "And they can be got to work for next to nothing." Known to history as Pickering's harem, the Harvard computers cataloged 10,000 stars. Wilhelmina Fleming, the erstwhile maid, discovered the Horsehead Nebula and helped develop a common designation system for stars, while her colleague, Annie Jump Cannon, could classify spectra at a rate of 3 stars a minute, and with a remarkable consistency that allowed her to discover a number of new and unusual stars. These women quite literally mapped the cosmos, but their wages were equivalent to those of unskilled workers. Paid between 25 and 50 cents an hour, they earned barely more than they would have if they'd worked in a factory. In the United States, the number of female office workers increased near the end of the 19th century, with a significant uptick after the American Civil War. Major wars have an unmistakable effect on gender and work, opening new employment to women. In this case, many were battlefield widows, looking to support themselves by helping to coordinate the affairs of an increasingly complex world. After the Civil War ended in 1865, as historian David Alan Greer writes, female computers were no longer the talented daughters of loving fathers, as Mariah Mitchell had been, or the intelligent friends of sympathetic men, like Ada. They were workers, desk laborers, who were earning their way in this world with their skill at numbers. The First and Second World Wars, too, ushered thousands of women into the workplace as typists, clerks, and telephone operators, to say nothing of riveters. But it was the telephone companies that were the first mass employers of a female workforce. In 1891, 8,000 women worked as telephone operators. By 1946, nearly 250,000. Women were a nimble workforce, capable of working collaboratively in networks and fluid groups. We still speak of secretarial pools, adaptable to the needs of the enterprise. They staffed switchboards, kept records, took dictation, and filed documents. These rote office tasks are now increasingly performed electronically by digital assistants and automated telephonic systems, many of which still speak, in the default, with female voices. As female voices buzzed across the growing telephone networks in the first half of the 20th century, the term girl was used interchangeably with computer. One member of the Applied Mathematics Panel, a division of the National Defense Research Committee that administered a human computing group in the early 1940s, ballparked a unit of kilogirl energy as being equivalent to roughly 1,000 hours of computing labor. The National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the predecessor to NASA, kept its own pool of girls, which included black women as early as the 1940s, working in a segregated west section of Langley Research Center. One of these, the mathematician Katherine Johnson, who joined the Space Task Force in 1958, hand-calculated trajectories for Alan Shepard's and John Glenn's spaceflights. The computing group at Langley ran all its analytical calculations by hand, using the material ephemera of the gig. Slide rules, magnifying glasses, curves, and early calculating machines. Johnson is often quoted as saying that she was a computer back in the days when the computer wore a skirt. The last significant human computing project in the United States, a reference book of mathematical tables funded by the Works Progress Administration and overseen by another female mathematician, Gertrude Blanche, was published just as computing machines made it effectively obsolete. Human computing thrived as a stopgap between the emergence of large-scale scientific research and the capacity of hardware to carry out its calculations. Eventually, the tireless machines that emerged from the spike in computer science research during the Second World War wore down their competition. After that war, the machines took over, decisively and permanently, shifting the definition of the word computer for the first and last time. The job description, which once required a unique cohesion of human effort, changed too. One-time human computers went from rivals to keepers, no longer executing the functions of the machine, but rather programming those functions to be executed. Human computing offices performed in girl years the number crunching that machines can now perform in fractions of a second. But for a few centuries, groups of women working in hives and harems were the hardware, distributed biological machines capable of prodigious calculations beyond the mental capacities of any single individual. Calculations that cataloged the cosmos, charted the stars, measured the world, and built the bomb. That the mathematical labor might have been, in some cases, broken down into relatively simple steps for each individual is beside the point. It's the accumulation of all those steps, executed simultaneously and collectively, that prefigured our connected, calculating, big data world. Alone, women were the first computers. Together, they formed the first information networks. The computer as we know it today is named for the people it replaced. And long before we came to understand the network as an extension of ourselves, our great-grandmothers were performing the functions that brought about its existence. The arrival of computing machines may have emptied human computing offices, but it didn't push women from the field. Quite the opposite. Many women who had been computers themselves found work tending their replacements. Female hands lifted from pencils and slide rules to desk calculators and switches, then relays and punch card tabulators. Coaxing information into and out of the new machines was considered a woman's job too, on the level with typing, filing documents, and patching phone calls from place to place. Not that it was easy. Dealing with early mechanical computers required a keen analytical mind and limitless patience. Just like the women whose math moved mountains, early computer programmers and operators were tasked with enormous, intractable problems. Their creative solutions often meant the difference between life and death. Chapter 2. Amazing Grace. Grace Hopper was 36, tenure-tracked, and married when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. She taught mathematics. Her husband, Vincent, literature. The couple spent their summers fixing up an old farmhouse in New Hampshire, on 60 acres of land they'd bought during the Depression for $450. They played badminton, and Grace hooked rugs, a skill she'd picked up as a kid, summering at the family compound on Lake Wolfboro. Grace and Vincent lived the usual headaches of married academics. As Grace began her graduate studies at Yale, Vincent was working toward his doctorate at Columbia. Somehow she made time to help him research his 8-year-long thesis project, A History of Number Symbolism, by reading Syrian, Babylonian, and medieval texts on the subject. When she started teaching at Vassar in 1931, she audited courses in her spare time, picking up fluency in astronomy, geology, physics, and architecture. Her intellectual ambidexterity was legendary on campus. To impress students, she'd sometimes write a German sentence on the chalkboard with her left hand, and when she got to the middle, she'd switch to her right hand and finish the sentence in French. When Grace was a junior teacher at Vassar, she picked up the classes students dreaded and nobody else wanted to teach, like calculus, trigonometry, and mechanical drawing. To revitalize them, she updated old schoolwork with new concepts, much as good teachers do now. To make topography fun, she'd tell her mechanical drawing classes they were tracing the borders of fantastic, imaginary worlds. And she updated the ballistics problems, common to calculus textbooks, to involve rockets, which were then beginning to capture the public imagination. As a result, her classes swelled with students, drawn in from departments across the college. It earned her the respect of her superiors and the unbridled resentment of her colleagues. In the winter of 1941, Grace and Vincent were in New York City. Vincent had found a job teaching general literature at New York University's School of Commerce, and Grace had arranged a year-long faculty fellowship from Vassar to study at NYU herself, under Ricard Courant, one of the few major figures in applied mathematics. It was a nice break from the breakneck weekly commute they'd been driving along the Hudson, between Poughkeepsie and the city, in a Model A Ford she called Dr. Johnson. Grace liked Courant, who specialized in differential equations with finite differences, something she'd learned one jump ahead of the students to teach her calculus course at Vassar. Courant had a cute accent. He was a German emigre. And his lectures were always engaging. She enjoyed tackling unorthodox problems under his tutelage, even if he sometimes scolded her for taking equally unorthodox approaches to them. All in all, it was a gorgeous year. Then everything changed. Grace and Vincent heard the announcement on a tinny little radio, sitting at a double desk in the study they shared, surrounded by books. A violent and sudden attack at a naval base in Hawaii had left 2,403 Americans dead. The following day, the United States declared war on Japan. Within a week, the conflict extended to Japan's allies, Germany and Italy. Everybody in Grace's life wanted into the war. Vincent tried for a commission, but was turned down for wearing glasses. Grace's brother, scrawny as her whole family was and with a blind spot about level with a chalkboard, didn't make the cut either. Undeterred, they both volunteered under the draft and got in. Grace's cousin became a nurse. By the summer of 1942, everyone seemed to be gone. All the men enlisted, all the women in her family in the military's new female branches, save her sister, who had children. Grace wanted to do her part, too, but she was 16 pounds underweight and considered too old for service. Mathematics professors, being a classified profession, weren't allowed to enlist without a release. She took a summer appointment at Barnard College to teach special war preparedness mathematics courses for women, but it wasn't enough. All summer, midshipmen would march by the Barnard dormitories from a training ship on the Hudson, and Grace would watch them, longing to be in the Navy, too. Back upstate, she chafed with loneliness and directionless patriotism. "I was beginning to feel pretty isolated sitting up there," she said, the comfortable college professor. She aggressively lobbied Vassar to let her go into the service. She gave the college an ultimatum, which wasn't much of one. 6 months, or she'd leave anyway. And even though she was too old and too thin, and her eyesight wasn't much better than her brother's, she did. The day those bombs fell on Pearl Harbor, the path of completely respectable, middle-class life had been at Grace Hopper's feet, but she wouldn't take one step further. Within a few years, everything forked. She separated from Vincent, she quit her job, and she joined the U.S. Navy. It wasn't the first remarkable thing she'd ever done, and it would not be the last. Grace turned 37 on her first day at the United States Naval Reserve Midshipman School in Northampton, Massachusetts. She picked up the Navy talk quickly. Bulkheads, decks, and overheads. She'd always been good with languages. She'd taught herself German, Latin, and Greek by reading closely with a dictionary at her side, corralling the new words into each sentence like mathematical variables. Mastering military protocol was trickier, especially because it was so often at odds with social expectations. Rank and civility collided in doorways. Sometimes she'd stop to let admirals go through the doors first, but they'd try to treat her like a lady, the comedy of errors. "We usually ended up going through together," she recounted, which was bad. But she liked the drills. She thought they were like dancing. She was smaller than the other recruits, and older, training alongside the students she'd been teaching only months before. But after a career in academia, commuting around the Northeast while trying to maintain two homes and a strained marriage, the constraints of military life felt like a vacation. She didn't need to think about anyone else anymore. She didn't even need to pick out her own clothes in the morning. There were few comforts. Even nylons were rationed. But her domestic responsibilities had disappeared. "I just reveled in it," she told a historian years later. Unlike the youngsters she enlisted with, she had the most complete freedom. "I just promptly relaxed into it like a feather bed and gained weight and had a perfectly heavenly time." With meat rationed, she ate fresh fish from the New England coast and lobster every Sunday night. She was named battalion commander and graduated first in her class in itchy Lyle stockings. Although Grace was certain the Navy would have sent her to sea had she been a man, the newly minted Lieutenant Hopper would never spend a day on board a Navy ship. Instead, something in her employment history rang a bell. Of all things, her study of finite differences at NYU, under Ricard Courant, the Navy changed Grace's orders overnight. In training, she'd assumed her military career would be spent cracking enemy codes with the elite group of mathematicians and logicians at the Communications Annex, the Navy's cryptographic brain trust, overseen by one of Grace's former Yale professors. She even studied cryptography to prepare for that eventuality. Instead, the Navy sent her to Harvard, where, as she liked to say, she became the third programmer of the world's first computer. When she arrived at Harvard in July 1944, she promptly got lost. The Navy liaison office was nowhere to be found, and Grace hadn't been given any information about where she was to be stationed or why. She wandered the campus until she was finally led into the basement of the university's Kraft Physics Laboratory by an armed guard. A hawkish, 6'4" man with an exaggerated widow's peak greeted her at the door, already irritated. The first words out of his mouth? "Where have you been?" Taken aback by the sight of him, she said she'd just come from midshipman school and had spent the morning looking for the right place. "I was a little bewildered, and at that point, of course, thoroughly scared of a commander," she remembered. "I told them you didn't need to do that," he muttered. He didn't think women needed service training. He asked if she'd found a place to live yet. She told him she'd only just arrived. "Well," he answered, "get to work, and you can get a place to live tomorrow." Get to work she did. Grace never saw any action during the war, but she did tame two beasts. The first was this bristly man, Lieutenant Commander Howard Aitken. While a graduate student in physics at Harvard, Aitken, a great admirer of Charles Babbage, had designed a mechanical arithmetic device capable of solving any problem, from basic arithmetic to differential equations, that could be simplified down to numerical analysis. It was a matter of convenience. His own doctoral dissertation had been a nightmare of extensive, tedious calculations. His machine, built by IBM in exchange for the rights, and donated to the university for wartime use, would be Grace's second beast. Because Aitken had imagined it as a series of daisy-chained calculators doing the work of a dozen men, it was an automatic sequence-controlled calculator. Everyone at Harvard called it the Mark I computer. The Mark I was assigned to the Navy's Bureau of Ordnance to run ballistics problems for the war effort, and Aitken needed mathematicians who knew their way around differential equations with finite differences, precisely what Grace had been studying under Ricard Courant, that glorious year before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. But Grace didn't know any of this yet. As she made Aiken's acquaintance, she heard a racket in the next room.